This is Carl Smiley from Summit, Oregon. You are listening to KORCLPFM 105.9, Corvallis, Oregon, streaming at KORCFM.com.
The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
Hello, KORC listeners. Welcome to the Corvallis Civics Cafe for December 22nd. What items are on our menu this week? There was a double serving of City Council meetings on Monday, with a bonus portion of a Planning Commission meeting on Wednesday. Want to know what was said and how the votes got voted? Of course you do. Let's go. The double-decker of City Council meetings on December 16th were less spicy than I thought they would be. Less spicy, but still filling, with the work session and the regular meetings held back-to-back. The only item on the agenda for the work session was to start the conversation about how to finance the construction of the new city buildings. Community members, as well as some city councilors, had hoped to forestall this conversation to the new year so that the newly elected councilors could participate. In lieu of waiting, all four of the new council members were invited to sit at the table for this meeting. It made for a crowded table, with three councilors-elect there in person and one participating via Zoom. This was a smart move by the council leadership, as it diffused the anxiety that I and others had felt leading up to this discussion on Monday. The work session opened with a staff report from Director of Finance, James Inglis, with City Manager Mark Shepard and Special Consultant Mary Steckel joining him. The question at hand, with City Council recently passing a resolution determining to construct new city administrative and police department facilities, how will we find the revenue to finance this $200 million endeavor? Our entire city budget last year was less than $190 million. So, what are our options? The six options presented were a payroll tax, a general obligation bond, a local sales tax, increasing the lodging tax, upping service fee charges, or reducing city services. At the end of their presentation, staff stated their goal was to get a sense of which items the council thought viable. They made a pitch for hiring a consultant to help with the next steps in the process, then opened the floor to discussion, encouraging the council members to add suggestions of their own regarding means of creating revenue. Outgoing Ward 4 Councilor Gabe Shepard began the discussion by noting that the city charter gives council members the ability to decide how to raise revenue. However, any decision they make could well be sent to a vote of the people by referendum, as the public has 30 days to gather signatures to recall an ordinance via a vote, and it would take 2,067 signatures to achieve this in Corvallis. We do elect our councilors to make decisions, but we the people also have means of checks and balances, which was witnessed in Salem recently when their city council passed a payroll tax. The people of Salem, unhappy with that decision, collected signatures for a ballot measure and subsequently voted down that payroll tax. It was noted that a similar situation could be avoided in Corvallis if the city council were to declare an ordinance as an emergency, but based on the feedback from the councilors at the meeting, there is not much stomach for trying to force any revenue generation on an unhappy public. Most of the council agree that the city badly needs to address our aged facilities, but all options discussed have both pros and cons. I would note that in and of itself, a payroll tax could be a useful tool and is more equitable than flat fees, such as those on our city services bill, which are proportionally more burdensome on lower-income residents. There is a strong interest in learning more about a payroll tax amongst our city councilors, but it is doubtful that such a tax on its own would raise enough revenue to cover the $200 million bill for these projects. This led to more discussion about priorities and costs, with Ward 4 Councilor-elect Olson asking about less expensive designs for the buildings. There was talk of separating the two projects or using different types of revenue for each of them. There were suggestions for other means of raising revenue, with Ward 6 Councilor-elect Bowden suggesting a tax on undeveloped or vacant property, and Ward 8 Councilor-elect Mayors suggesting a corporate income tax or a fuel tax. Councilor Napak suggested a commuter tax, but I'm not sure it would be a good idea to impose a new tax on people who already cannot afford to live here. As for reducing services, what do we want less of? the city council discussed that Corvallis exercises good financial management and there's not a lot of fat to trim. No one offered up any services to be reduced. In the end, everyone at the table agreed that a special consultant should be hired, but no one asked how much that would cost. This consultant would help research the pros and cons of the various means of raising revenue. The city manager noted that there are state-mandated guidelines for how such consultants are hired, and the process starts with staff creating a request for proposal, and the proposal can include input from the city council. As was promised, this is just the beginning of this process, which likely will take 6 to 8 weeks or more to unfold. In the meantime, many councilors noted that much work remains to be done regarding discussion of the projects with the public. My favorite comments of this meeting came when Ward 3 Councilor-elect Moorfield pushed back on the idea of, quote, educating, unquote, the public about the need for these new facilities. Instead, he encourages more effective engagement with the public about the needs and the benefits of the projects. Well said, Jim, and I look forward to hearing more from you in 2025. The work session concluded, and there was a short intermission before the council moved forward with the last scheduled meeting for the year. During community comments, Dave Rabinowitz made some excellent points, with comments geared toward the civic campus discussion at the work session. He suggested that staff and council review history to see how previous building projects were successfully funded, and reminded everyone that the people of Corvallis do not want or need a Cadillac building. A showcase building will alienate a lot of residents. Let's have something practical, useful, and ecological. Yes, Dave, thank you for saying that. The city council then moved forward with many votes to close out the year. The majority of the votes regarded increases for city service fees, which will go into effect February 1st. These increases are due to inflation and additional work needed to maintain Corvallis's core infrastructure, such as water and sewer services. There are 6 fee increases as follows. Water rates will increase 17.5%. Wastewater rates will increase 3%. Stormwater rates will increase 3%. The transportation maintenance fee will increase by 16%. Sidewalks maintenance fee will increase by 30 cents, and the fire service fee will increase by $2.50 for a typical residential customer. Collectively, these increases will result in an additional $9.04 per month for the average single-family residence. Acknowledging that these increases are challenging for some residents to afford, the council also voted unanimously to increase the financial assistance available via the Low Income Assistance Program. More information about that program, including the application form, can be found on the city website at corvallisoregon.gov. You can type Low Income Assistance in the search field to navigate to the correct page. The council also voted to approve that the Downtown Corvallis organization be granted responsibility for renewing the city's affiliated Main Street application, which should be good news for our downtown businesses as we roll into 2025. Votes were also held to fill vacancies on our Planning Commission, and all 3 of the newly appointed commission members were able to participate in the Planning Commission meeting on Wednesday, the 18th of December. Finally, time was devoted to thanking the outgoing councilors for their time and service to the community. No one is getting rich serving on our city council. It is a volunteer position, which might have some perks, but certainly requires dedication, patience, and resolve. As I noted earlier, there was a Planning Commission meeting on the 18th, and CAFE listeners might be interested to know that the commission voted unanimously in support of the Obie Corporation's plans to build a 7-story hotel and apartment building at the now-shuttered location of Flattail Brewery and the warehouse for Blackledge Furniture. The Obie Corporation owns that entire stretch of First Street between Madison and Jefferson, as well as 2 other vacant lots in the downtown area. The application approved by the Planning Commission includes ground floor retail and restaurants, a 75-room hotel to the north of the block, and a 92-room apartment complex to the south of the block. There will be a second-floor garage with spaces for 45 cars and 92 bikes for the apartment complex. Hotel guest parking will be managed via valet at off-site locations. Next steps for this project involve a presentation and vote of the City Council, and the project itself could get started in mid-2025. Folks interested in learning more can visit the city website, corvallisoregon.gov, and in the search field type Gordon Hotel, or you can email me at wendy@korcfm.com, and I will help you find information. As we approach the end of 2024, I thank you for listening to KORC's News, Music, and Civics, and hope you have enjoyed the Civics Cafe. I plan to continue covering city council and city politics as we move into 2025, and appreciate any feedback you have for me. I have one item to request of you, the listener, something I think all of us could benefit from as we lean into a year that already feels fraught with political stress. Let's all stay focused and engaged on local news and do our best to inform ourselves, our friends, our neighbors, our community, in ways we can make Corvallis a better place to be. Thanks for listening. If you have any comments or questions, send me an email at wendy@korcfm.com. And if you have feedback for KORC's News, Music, and Civics, email us at news@korcfm.com. Happy winter, Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, and goodbye 2024. Don't let the door hit you in the butt on the way out. This is Wendy Byrne for KORC.
On Tuesday, December 17th, the 9th grade Corvallis Spartans boys basketball team faced off against the Roseburg Indians. It was a home game, and for the hometown favorites, the 9th grade Corvallis Spartans, it was their first victory of the season. That's not to say that Roseburg didn't put up a good game. The Spartans managed to stay ahead throughout the entire game, however, though there were times the Roseburg Indians showed promise. Many of their scores were three-point shots, and the game overall was a fair matching of skill level, with the Spartans taking a humble victory of 63 over the visiting team's final score of 52. It gave the local youngins reason to celebrate, a chance to feel confidence in future games, both at home and in opposing teams' courts. Now, you may be wondering to yourself at this point, Roseburg Indians? Isn't it the mid-2020s? To which the answer is yes. But then you really look at the state of national politics and you say, oh yeah, it's the mid-2020s, all right. And you think ahead to 2025 and the project that is supposedly coming with it. And then, maybe a name like Roseburg Indians isn't all that big a surprise. It should be noted, it's not like the good people of Roseburg didn't try. Back in the winter and spring of 2021, during the pandemic, there were months of debate, a petition with over 7,000 signatures, and even a 5-1 vote on the Roseburg School Board in favor of ditching the culturally tone-deaf mascot name of the Indians. Despite the majority of the 5-1 vote, the measure failed because the Roseburg School District has a policy on changing school names and mascots. The Roseburg Public Schools Superintendent Jared Corden said, "This motion does require unanimous vote of the board, which means it needs all board members to vote yes. And so in this case, the vote does not carry," unquote. So in the end, it was all thanks to one man and his vote that the overwhelming will of the community and the vote of the school board was tossed out like yesterday's trash. Charles Lee was that man, the lone no vote on the school board. He assured the community of his stance with statements including that he, quote, "did look at the science and sociology that was offered and found that it did not support the broad claims of harm that were being made to justify or support the need to change the name," unquote. Yes, thanks to that one man, and despite the will of much of the Roseburg community, the Roseburg Indians are currently stuck with that unfortunate and perhaps unlucky name. And that bad luck carried over into at least Tuesday's game, as the Roseburg Indians had no luck when it came to beating the Corvallis Spartans. At the game, the parents of the visiting team roared enthusiastically when their players scored. But it was to no avail. By the end of the first period, the Spartans were ahead 15-6. Nearby, a boy could be seen chewing on a tinfoil ball. The youth took a second bite as he thought no one watched. His peers largely did not notice and were on their phones. The teams passed the ball around with interference, ball thievery, even a level of struggle that would have gotten us 90s kids a foul, easily. The young men aggressively tend one another, hands on, light shoving, plenty of talking smack. A young man says to another, "Get off me." The other responds, "Yeah," and guards another player. The other player says, "Get away," among other jeers, but the crowd noise drowns it out. Nearby, a group of students poke fun at one another, some looking at their phone, others lightly engaged with the game. The sound of shoes squeak. Nearby, the young man continues to take slow bites out of the medium-sized ball of tinfoil. No one reacts verbally. An enthusiastic mother does what appears to be the chicken dance in hope that other parents will join her. Without the music to go along, other parents awkwardly decline the invitation to join in the dance. The mother sits down, her husband looking uncomfortably into his phone. By halftime, the score of the game was 26-17. By now, the parents and students of the Corvallis Spartans could sense that the hometown heroes had the game in the bag. Another game took place in an adjacent gymnasium, as this upstairs gymnasium we were in proved that it too had what it took to draw and engage a crowd. The game carried on with both teams making a number of 2- and 3-point shots. It was said that the referees were a little lax when it came to calling fouls on the visiting team, but we won't talk about that. At one point, during a timeout, both teams shot free throw baskets, and at one point, the ball bounced and landed square on a player's head as he walked away. It then bounced highly back into the air. A father and son found this amusing.
So perfectly timed.
The hometown heroes gave the Roseburg Indians a run for their money, which hopefully there was no money put on Tuesday's game, unless it was bet on the Spartans, because by the end of the game, even with a Roseburg player scoring at the last second, the ninth grade Corvallis Spartans beat Roseburg with a final score of 63-52. By the end of the game, both teams agreed to the usual treaty and tradition of lining up to fist bump and lightly contact members of the opposing team, wishing them a good game. The parents slowly rose from the stands, saying things like, "It's time to go home." One family was heard discussing ideas of where to go out and eat. I had a chance to check in with Coach Max of the winning team.
Coach Max, how do you feel after the game?
Well, I feel great. I mean, this is a good first win for me, and let's continue to build on it game by game, right?
It was pretty surprising. I actually thought that Roseburg was going to catch up and maybe even beat them, but You just took it home?
Right, yeah. I was really confident in our team throughout the whole four quarters. We pressured well. We did game plan. I think we pushed it for a whole four energies, which helped a lot. So, yeah, I think it was pretty good.
Very good. Well, congrats on today's win.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
I also had a chance to speak with star player and notable defense guard of the Corvallis Spartans, number 33, John Krall.
What were your thoughts on today's game?
It went pretty well.
You actually scored a good shot there.
Yeah, but I missed more than I made.
Oh, that's okay. You're not feeling bad about that, are you?
Yeah, I am.
Well, you still did a good job.
Thanks.
As the media crew headed toward the stairwell, a boy stared into the lights overhead. A slow dimming began, without official explanation. For KORC, News, Music, and Civics, I'm Dan Krall, in the upstairs gym at Corvallis High School in Corvallis, Oregon.
The University of Oregon has digitized and uploaded scans of historic newspapers from our region, dating back to the mid-19th century. These are available from the UofO Library's website and are in the public domain. As these documents record the views and events of an active settler colonial society during a time of indigenous displacement and cultural genocide, some of the material here is strange, shocking, and rightly detestable. Some information may also reveal admirable qualities of people in the past. Still, don't forget that the true complexity of human lifeways is not recorded in newspapers, books, or even oral histories. Humans are always liable to erase, distort, and embellish information to reinforce their worldview. In the context of history, our ancestors and predecessors can be thought of as a foreign culture to us, embodying a different economic, technological, and social reality. From the comfort of the present, we can look with a curious eye back to the things we were right to outgrow, the things we still carry with us, and the things we wish we hadn't lost and may remember again. According to David Fagan's History of Benton County, the Corvallis Gazette was started in 1863 as a vigorously partisan supporter of the then-new Republican Party, and was a leading voice in the temperance movement against the consumption of alcohol. In 1876, the Gazette was made into a corporation, a reflection of the far-flung, moneyed interests fueling the nascent media industry of westward migration. Here are some excerpts from the Corvallis Gazette, December 12th, 1879. Tokens of National Prosperity. For the year ending October 31st, the balance of trade in favor of the United States was $269 million. These figures show how strong and what a wonderful factor in the commercial world our country has become. But a few years since, when we were burdened with debts, and the interest in the public debt caused us to put forth every endeavor to meet its prompt payment, and when the country was stricken with business paralysis, the balance of trade was annually $150 million against us. But our people have learned wisdom by experience and have, for several years last past, been practicing economy with very desirable results. Costly equipages and large establishments have given way to the more simple and less expensive modes of living. Resumption has been a great boon to the country in restoring credit abroad and inspiring confidence at home. While idle mills and factories have again resumed business after a long and distressing silence, furnishing employment to thousands of our laboring population, the lively, strong, and active pulse of reviving trade is felt through every avenue of business. Never before have businessmen felt such confidence in the future as at present. Railroads are being projected and forced forward to completion with an energy heretofore unknown, and are opening to settlement large and portions of the public domain that is lain idle for want of sufficient means of transporting their products to the seaboard. We have been blessed with large crops of every description, and they've realized the producer good prices, while the Republican Party has been given a new lease of power by increased majorities. It would seem that Providence is on our side, not only blessing us with enormous crops and a consequent business revival, but by allowing the Democratic Party to exist to commit blunders that ensure to the prosperity of the Republican cause. The elections this fall have retired such bourbons as Thurman of Ohio, Kernan of New York, Eaton of Connecticut, and all U.S. senators whose terms expire March 4, 1880. In their places will be elected sound Republicans who believe in the sovereignty of the nation and are attached to its principles and honor, and who will not, by any word or act of theirs, aid the rebel brigaders in robbing the national treasure to pay for mules or cattle or slaves captured or destroyed during the late war. Gold by the shipload is coming to our shores to pay for our cereals and manufactured fabrics. The nations of the earth believe in us, believe that we are capable and willing to pay our just obligations, and at the same time take care of all our people, besides contributing largely to the distress of other lands. Our credit is almost unbounded and will remain so just so long as we live soberly and practice the economy taught us in the severe school of the past. No nation is more respected than ours, none that exerts the enlightening influences in the world. To whom do we owe all this? To the great ruler of nations, through the instrumentality of the Republican Party. A tidal wave of prosperity, unequaled before in our history, has enveloped the entire country, and the nation is vigorous, active, aggressive, and is just entering upon an era of usefulness, enlightenment, and grandeur before unknown. The following extract is from the Daily Oregonian's commercial column. The several vessels at hand and on the berth are filling up with good dispatch, and there being but few other ships in the market, it seems there is some difficulty in breaking the market for freights, which are still held at a high figure. The italics are my own, and are given to show what has occurred every year since Oregon commenced shipping grain to Europe, and I can see no stronger plea or argument for another shipping point, particularly for Central Oregon. It is asserted that Eastern Oregon alone can load all the vessels en route to the Columbia River, and no one can doubt, with her facilities for transportation, that she will do it. And if so, pray, what will Central Oregon do with her crop? Of course, she can patiently wait until warehouse charges and interest on notes eats up the year's profit, and truly this would be a burden of intolerable weight to the producer and a serious obstacle to the future growth of the Willamette. If it was not for the fact that within 60 miles of the central part of the state, nature has made a harbor of sufficient magnitude to offer a cheap, certain, and independent route for all the outgoing and incoming trade of the country. Without desiring to anticipate official report on this subject, I will say that men of observation and experience have asserted that even testified that there was no bar at Yaquina Bay and there was a reef across the channel, rising on either side, confining the water, keeping the same in certain limited bounds. This theory has been substantiated by never-varying direction of the channel, the same beacons being used, the same depth of water remaining on the reef. When we consider that there is no sand spit north of the Yaquina Channel to drift, as at other points, south with the strong north winds causing channels to shift south and even fill up, and that there is no sand spit north of Yaquina Channel to drift up the coast and fill the channel from a southerly direction, we have every assurance that this channel is fixed, running out clear and well-defined, as Chase has it, west, giving a vessel a fair wind to enter from southeast to northwest, as there is 4.5 to 5 fathoms up to this reef, and like a depth found inside as soon as you cross it. We feel confident in obtaining 20 feet or more low tide, and confining the waters and blasting out this obstruction. With 7 1/10 feet rise, we have a harbor deep enough to float any vessel that now comes to Portland. Several months ago, I begged the people of the valley to arise and work for Foulweather as affording a shipping point for the central part of the state, and was pleased to see the deep interest manifested. For reasons that may never be understood, Foulweather received but little favor in the examination made by the Board of Engineers, so little indeed that my enthusiasm fell with their departure. Now there is a chance to regain lost ground. With a small appropriation, the farmers of the valley can be free to ship to the point offering the best market. And without repeating arguments 14 years old, I ask in the interest of all classes, producer and consumer, landlord and tenant, to rally and urge, plead and demand in the name of progress, prosperity, and general development and wealth, that Congress give us the small sum necessary to complete the little nature has left undone. The day and hour is propitious. The cause one closely interwoven with every market material interest of the valley. Let us petition our members in Congress. Help them with all our might. Every name is strength. United, it is a power present condition must and will respect. Rialto, Newport, Oregon, November 29th, 1879. From Portland. Portland, December 1st, 1879. As we write this date, the inclination comes strong to moralize a little. We are commencing the last month of the decade. The 70s will soon be a thing of the past, and 1880 a living present. How the years roll by. It seems only yesterday since we were writing in 69. Yet another 10 years have been added to our lives. We who are living are 10 years nearer the narrow home appointed for all the living than we were then. And yet, if we have within us the consciousness of duty well performed, the passing years have no pang, but will light up the pathway as we go down the declivity of life towards its sunset with a halo bright, beautiful, and well-pleasing. The decade just going out marks a new era for Oregon. She has thrown off the garb of youth and assumed a place which has brought her to the notice and respect of the world. Our products are attracting the attention of the whole world, and the internal improvements now being made are the sure harbingers that in a few years she will be united with the eastern states by bands of steel and covered with a network of connecting railroads. The growth of Portland. I have not at hand any statistics of the actual growth of Portland during this year, but comparing it with the improvements last year, the number of buildings erected will not fall much short of 1,000, and yet there are but few empty houses or stores. From this, your readers can form some idea of the steady and rapid growth of the city. Real estate is quite brisk, and prices have very largely advanced since the commencement of the year. The progress of the state is, I believe, fully equal proportionately to that of the city. The next census will surprise even the most sanguine as to our population. Judge Bellinger closed the October term of the circuit court Saturday, having to go to Oregon City to try the Hagar murderers Monday. This leaves a large amount of equity business undisposed of. The judge has labored incessantly during the term to advance the business, but there is a limit to human capacity, and there is too much business for one man to do. This district will have to be divided. Multnomah County alone furnishes enough business for one judge. Akin to this topic of courts, I have heard considerable said lately concerning the election of supreme judges next year. It is a question in which every citizen of the state is vitally interested. Upon the integrity, learning, and ability of the judges of the courts of the state depend largely the security of person and property. A corrupt or ignorant judiciary can do no more to unsettle the confidence of people in their rights of personal liberty and property, and to impair the fair fame and credit of our state abroad than most men are aware, at first thought. I should like to vote for Republican judges, but I had very much rather support incorruptible and able ones. Politics should be a matter of secondary importance in the selection of these officials, and I hope that in the selection of candidates for these positions, that the Jeffersonian qualifications, honest and capable, will be applied rather than a particular accent of any party shibboleth. Some few persons who seek to rule the Republican Party seem to wish for a renewal of the differences that have divided the Republican Party in this state in the past. As a Republican, I am very sorry to see this. With the party united, Oregon is as surely Republican as any one of her sisterhood states. As a result of divisions in the party, we now have a Democratic representation in Congress, which is solid for the solid South, led by the rebel brigadiers, and ready to vote by any measure which may be demanded by those rebels. There is still quite enough of the Democratic Party with its schemes and repudiation, its wild financial theories and shotgun policy to engage the united opposition of the Republican ranks. And however much I may have differed with some, yet if they are desirous of now casting their votes with the Republican Party in its great struggle for the national supremacy in 1880, I give them a friendly greeting and a brotherly welcome in the ranks of today. Any attempt at prescription in the Republican ranks is political suicide of the most foolish kind. Etc., etc., Portland, Oregon. There are two Chinese now in jail under sentence of death. Ah Lee applies for the executive clemency because his partner in crime was found guilty of only murder in the second degree, and Wong Fook applies on the ground that Ah Lee has asked for pardon when he claims that his crime was not so great as Ah Lee's. But thinking people rather regard this matter with the idea that if these Chinese are pardoned, poor white men can be hung while rich Chinamen can't. An interesting case of attempted bribery was tried in the circuit court the other day. In the case of the state versus John A. Carr, he was accused of attempting to bribe a councilman in the choice of a police commissioner, and while there was a good deal of testimony showing something rotten, yet he was acquitted on technical grounds. The go-between who appeared in the witness stand seemed guiltier of the two. Corvallis News. The Oregonian of the Ninth Institution again announces that the citizens of Corvallis may expect a ride on the West Side Railroad about Christmas as the iron has been taken out to the front. That's just what we most desire. Our citizens would like to have the pleasure of making our New Year call on the metropolis by rail. To the teachers of Linn and Benton counties. A teachers' institute has been appointed to meet in Corvallis at 9 o'clock a.m., Monday, December 22nd, 1879, and to continue 2 days and a half. All teachers of the public schools of these two counties are cordially invited to be present to participate in its work and share its benefits. A good program has been arranged and competent instructors secured. Let every person who expects to either make or maintain a reputation as a live, energetic, progressive teacher, and who is within reasonable distance of this institute, be present, and aid in making it the very best possible. Let no trivial excuse prevent your coming. It is to be hoped that boards of directors will help in this work, at least so far as to allow teachers to adjourn their schools long enough to attend the institute without requiring to make up the necessary time so spent. Professor E.B. McElroy, eminently able and efficient county superintendent of Benton County, is earnestly working to make the gathering one of the great profit to those who may attend. Not teachers alone, but all persons who may feel interested in making our schools more efficient are respectfully invited to attend and participate in the work. Persons paying full fare on the railroad in going to the institute will be returned free. L.J. Powell, Superintendent, Public Institute, Salem, Oregon, December 3rd, 1879.
Solstice occurs twice during the year. The winter solstice takes place when the path of the sun in the sky is farthest south here in the northern hemisphere. And for summer solstice, That is when the sun is farthest north in the southern hemisphere, and that falls on June 20th or 21st. On the winter solstice, the sun travels the shortest path through the sky, and therefore has the least daylight and the longest night. On Saturday, sunrise was at 7:47 a.m. with sunset at 4:36 p.m. There are a number of Yule traditions, many of which having been integrated into the general Christmas holiday. Traditions such as hanging mistletoe and wreaths have roots in pagan solstice rituals. Natural items such as holly, ivy, evergreen boughs, and pine cones are meant to symbolize everlasting life, protection, and prosperity. Ancient societies meticulously observed the movements of the sun, recognizing the solstice's crucial role in the cycle of seasons. We can see alignments and monuments dedicated to the winter solstice in the remains of ancient societies. One of the earliest recorded celebrations of this natural event traces back to the Neolithic period, with structures like Newgrange in Ireland, designed to align with the solstice sunrise. The precision of these ancient constructions underscores the significance of this celestial event dating back many ages. Contemporary pagan and other communities today observe the winter solstice as Yule, emphasizing themes of rebirth, renewal, and the return of light. Rituals involve lighting candles, meditation, and acknowledging the cycles of nature. Starting this past Saturday, the days are getting progressively longer up until the summer solstice around June 21st or 22nd. Happy winter solstice from all of us at KORC, listener-supported community radio in Corvallis, streaming online at korcfm.com.
Of your soul. So enter the night and you'll can be when you give birth to the dreams of your soul. And enter the night and you'll find the light that will carry you to your dreams. Enter the night, let your spirit take flight in the field of infinite possibilities. Enter the night and you'll find the light. Enter the night and you'll find the light. Enter the night and you'll find.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Dan Krall. On Saturday, December 14th, a semi-truck and trailer carrying a shipment of pesticides rolled over near mile marker 32 on a sharp turn along Forest Road 11 near Minnice Creek, which is a tributary of Quartzville Creek in the Sweet Home area. Luckily, none of the packaged pesticide material spilled in the accident. Multiple agency efforts were underway to safely remove the truck and trailer, clearing potential hazards. Those state and local agencies include the Linn and Benton County Emergency Managers, the Linn County Sheriff's Office, Benton County Sheriff's Office, the Oregon State Fire Marshal, the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, the Oregon Department of Emergency Management, and the OSFM's Regional Hazmat Team 5, consisting of Albany, Corvallis, and Lebanon fire personnel. As of Thursday the 19th, the hazardous materials were successfully removed from the truck that went off the side of this remote road in the Willamette National Forest on Saturday the 14th. The truck was carrying solid pesticides for commercial sale, when the driver lost control on a hairpin turn and the truck rolled onto a steep embankment. The driver is okay, and the pesticide remained intact on the trailer until it was removed the morning of Thursday, the 19th. That was after 5 days of working to stabilize the truck on the embankment and draining it of diesel fuel to avoid water contamination. With the hazardous materials removed, the focus will now shift to a straightforward salvage operation as all risks to Quartzville Creek above Green Peter Reservoir have been eliminated. As of this past week, Forest Service Road 11 is still closed while the truck is removed and the road is assessed for road damage and will reopen as soon as it is safe to do so. There's more information online through the U.S. Forest Service at fs.usda.gov/Willamette. This is KORC, News, Music, and Civics.
This is Cork, News, Music, and Civics. The following is an excerpt from Democracy Now!, which aired on Wednesday, December 18th, 2024. For more information on national and international news, visit democracynow.org. This is Cork.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show looking at Donald Trump's renewed war on the press, which he's often called the enemy of the people. And in one recent rally, he talked about how someone could shoot through the press. On Monday, the president-elect sued the Des Moines Register. Parent company is Gannett and the pollster Ann Seltzer for publishing a poll just before the election that showed Trump trailing Harris in Iowa. While Trump ended up easily winning the state, he's now accusing the paper of committing, quote, brazen election interference, unquote. Trump laid out his plans to target the Des Moines Register and other news outlets during a news conference Monday at Mar-a-Lago.
And I feel I have to do this. I shouldn't really be the one to do it. It should have been the Justice Department or somebody else, but I have to do it. It costs a lot of money to do it, but We have to straighten out the press. Our press is very corrupt, almost as corrupt as our elections.
Trump's lawsuit against the Des Moines Register came just days after ABC News, which is owned by Disney, settled a defamation suit filed by Trump. The network agreed to donate $15 million to Trump's presidential library and pay $1 million in legal fees to Trump's lawyer. Trump sued the network after ABC anchor George Stephanopoulos said Trump was found liable for rape in a 2023 civil case in Manhattan brought by writer E. Jean Carroll. ABC has been widely criticized for agreeing to settle instead of going to court to fight what many believed to be a winnable case. The prominent attorney, Mark Elias, responded to the settlement by writing, "Knee bent, ring kissed. Another legacy news outlet chooses obedience," unquote. The New York Times is reporting Trump and his allies are threatening to file more defamation lawsuits and attempt to crack down on unfavorable media coverage. Trump has also picked Kash Patel to head the FBI. Patel has a record of threatening to go after journalists. We're joined now by Chris Layman, D.C. Bureau Chief for The Nation. His latest piece is headlined, "Trump's Attack on the Free Press is Just Getting Started." Chris, start off with the Des Moines Register suit and then move on to ABC. What's happening here?
Well, what's happening is a very clear pattern in Trump's public life. It actually well antedates his rise to political power. He made a practice of frequently going after journalists for defamation. He famously sued one of his biographers who wrote in his this biography that Trump did not qualify as a billionaire. And in his subsequent deposition, Trump basically said he was a billionaire because he felt like a billionaire. This is a longstanding pattern of just intimidation of the press. And Trump was very open as a private business person that that was his aim. He wanted to exert a chilling effect on people doing critical reporting from him. Now, of course, he has the awesome power of the federal government behind him, or prospectively behind him. And ABC disgracefully capitulated right away. And the Des Moines Register suit is a clear auger of what's lying ahead. At the Mar-a-Lago conference you mentioned, Trump also threatened to sue Washington Post reporter Bob Woodward, the Pulitzer Prize, Pulitzer Peace Prize committee for these, you know, alleged offenses against basically Trump's bottomless vanity. So by capitulating, you know, sort of preemptively the way ABC has, this news organization has set the stage for a torrent of similar suits like this. You know, Trump will end his henchmen like Kash Patel. Also, Pete Hegseth has threatened a defamation suit against the person alleging sexual assault against him. You know, this will be a prime MO of the second Trump administration. And it's very worrisome that even before Trump takes office, ABC is without cause, you know, giving in. It sends a very distressing signal. In point of fact, what George Stephanopoulos said on the air was just a paraphrase of what the judge in Trump's, in the E. Jean Carroll case, said. He said that even though Trump's conduct in the case did not rise to the strict definition of rape under New York law, any common sense understanding of rape suggests that Trump did, in fact, commit that act.
So the judge said that.
The judge in the case. So there is not, this was not George Stephanopoulos just randomly popping off on the air. It was a documented claim.
And Chris, I wanted to ask you, in the Des Moines Register lawsuit, Trump is alleging consumer fraud by the Des Moines Register as a weapon. Could you talk about that particularly, and also the impact on these media companies, of many of which tend to want to settle just to get rid of a lawsuit?
Right, right. Yeah, the fraud charge is you know, as far as I know, has no legal basis. You can't, you know, just say because a pollster got something wrong, there is some deliberate intent to mislead. It's a plainly frivolous suit, but that is the point. This is a show of power on the part of an administration that we know from its prior turn in office takes every opportunity to demonize, harass, and intimidate the free press. The Des Moines Register suit is very much like the Trump biography suit I mentioned earlier. It's just his vanity was affronted by poll findings that, you know, turned out to be wrong. You know, I don't know what he can assert the damage has been if he won Iowa by 15 points after this poll was released. It is just a plain effort to harass and intimidate. To its credit, the Register's parent company, unlike Disney, which owns ABC, indicates it will be putting up a robust defense and, you know, in a sane court system, they will prevail. But, you know, all of this takes resources and money. And as you mentioned, Juan, you know, big companies don't want to be bothered with the hassle of, you know, going to court, even though, you know, these companies also have libel insurance precisely for cases like this. And they don't actually, you know, tend to suffer in terms of the bottom line.
I mean, this is extremely serious. When you look at the amount that ABC settled for, they were just about to go to depositions, right, of George Stephanopoulos and Trump, to discovery. So ABC called that off. $15 million plus another million for lawyers' fees. Any smaller news organization couldn't possibly deal with something like this. Then you have these news divisions that are not, profitable. They only profit Democracy, but a so-called, you know, financially profitable from these multinational or these very large corporations that own lots of other things like Bezos with the Washington Post. Right. And they care more about that other stuff. They don't want to be seen unfavorably by Trump. So they settle on the news issue. This is so extremely disturbing.
Yeah, and this is what happens when you have large corporations who are not—they don't have journalistic values, they don't have journalistic priorities. You know, as you said, the news operations are lost leaders for these figures, and Jeff Bezos has billions of dollars in government contracts. A publisher of the LA Times, it's the same story. He has extensive pharmaceutical holdings that are come under federal regulation. So he, too, is preemptively knuckling under to the Trump administration. He's killed editorials critical of Trump. He's installed this absurd new feature for readers of the paper to track bias and he's insisted that anything critical of Trump run alongside in the op-ed section, something that's the opposite point of view. This is more than just callow both sidesism. This is just craven corporate misconduct.
That's and Patrick Soon-Shiong, who owns the Los Angeles Times.
Thank you. Yes. This is what happens.
Chris, I wanted to ask you, we only have about a minute left. I wanted to ask you about the potential, what Trump could do with the FCC, especially in terms of broadcasters. Are there any concerns in that area?
Oh, absolutely. Cameron Barr, his nominee to head the FCC, is a very vocal critic of, you know, what in MAGA land is considered, you know, mainstream media censorship. He's gone on and on about how big tech in particular is, you know, during COVID and at other times have allegedly suppressed pet MAGA causes and talking points. So, there's a very real and immediate danger of, you know, the call will be coming from inside the White House soon when, Trump's FCC starts implementing policy. And it is all of a piece. It's really important to underline that, you know, what what we're going to see, I think, is what happened in Hungary under Orbán's rise to power. Trump and J.D. Vance are both ardent admirers of Viktor Orbán, and Orbán basically used his version of Elon Musk to buy out the national press and turn it into a party propaganda arm. That is a very real and present danger with Trump coming back into power and feeling this kind of impunity and this drive to avenge the people he sees as his enemies. It's crucial that the press hold the line and follow the example of Des Moines Register and not the example of ABC News.
We want to thank you, Chris Lehman, for being with us, D.C. Bureau Chief for The Nation. We'll link to your piece. Trump's attack on the free press is just getting started. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
That was an excerpt from Democracy Now!, which aired on Wednesday, December 18, 2024. For more information on national and international news, visit democracynow.org. This is Cork.
You'll feel fine. Light up the snow.